Oneganos is an indigenous water research project being led by McMaster University professor Dr. Don Martin Hill. The research project consists of team members helping in the co-creation of indigenous water quality tools and also indigenous ecological knowledge, training, and co-creation of mixed method tools. So here to talk to me about the project and some of the things happening with it is Dr. Don Martin Hill. So thank you for joining me today, Don.
Oh, thank you for having us.
I just wanted to start by maybe if you could tell us a little bit about the project itself and just why it was created.
Okay, so Global Water Futures, which was McMaster, University of Saskatchewan, Wilfrid Laurier and Western, applied for a Canadian Excellence Grant and they received $178 million. With that money, other researchers could apply to do water research, and so I did. Originally, it wasn't passed because we had included health and things that most hydrologists and engineers didn't think were fundable under GWF, but they soon changed their mind after speaking with, at the time, Chief Ava Hill, who walked them through for us why it mattered. And to say the least, they realized they were wrong, and now water and health are kind of commonplace, but I think we had a lot to do with changing that discussion that, you know, of course water is related to health and well-being. So that's how it started. It has engineers, biologists, computer engineers, clinical psychologists, medical staff, birthing center, Six Nations Health Services, Public Works. It's got eight teams all together, and they're all taking on various aspects that at the time the environmental officer, Clint King, and Fish and Wildlife was Paul General, and we talked to Public Works, the guys who do the water testing every day, and they advised and shaped what we looked at, and as well as Six Nations Health Services. So it was really a community designed project, which was unique in the world of scientific research. It's usually the scientist coming in with their plan, and either we go along with it or we don't. And in most cases, that's what we had to do. So this was designed by the community, for the community, prioritizing what the community thought was most important to assess.
And you talked about the relationship there between water and health and well-being. And since I've been doing some information on the project, there's a lot of different avenues that's been created within the project. You mentioned the creation of indigenous water quality tools. Some of the water protectors in the project have campaigned against organizations like Nestle in the No Nestle campaign. Virtual reality storytelling methods have also been gaining attention. You guys touch
the
on...
The mapping is getting pretty big too. The mapping project is probably one of the most well-received.
Can you just explain why it's so important for this project to really touch on all of those areas instead of just focusing in on the water aspect?
Well, I think that it is all water. So at the end of the day, the part of the virtual reality and the mapping project is designed to what we call disseminate, or scientists call knowledge mobilization, knowledge translation. It's making sure the community can understand the research, how to read water quality data in a really easy way. We have climate change data, which is going to severely impact Six Nations. We've published all of this in peer-reviewed scientific journals. But the tools that community needs, both in schools, to be able to have the community aware of water quality, which will become very important in the future as it is today, we needed tools developed so that they could do that. So we were advised by our traditional knowledge team, largely made up of faith keepers, other folks in the Confederacy were integral to this project from the beginning. And they thought it best to create a VR, and we're now developing a gaming aspect because it's about the youth. It's about the future generations being very water literate in every way, understanding how to test water, understanding how to use the sensors, but also our treaties, our rights to water, our rights to our way of life. So it combined both traditional ecological knowledge with scientific knowledge, and they thought the VR would be the most engaging way to get youth, and not just Six Nations youth, but youth in general, familiar with how important it is to steward and care for the water, as well as advance some understanding of why we as Indigenous people want to see our waterways clean. So we have, you know, listened to community, and then I approached Mohawk College, and they were just setting up their new VR lab, and we came to an agreement, and they've been helping us. Granted, it's slow. Most people aren't aware, as researchers, like our full-time job is teaching, being professors. Research is supposed to take about 20% of your year, and I'd say this has taken about 80% of my time. So we've dedicated an incredible amount of energy because community, like we're not a full-time, you know, staff and office. So we do things slowly, slower than the community would like. But that's how a research project runs. And the goal is to get everybody familiar. On the governance side, we do have the United Nations University as a partner. We have lawyers. Dr. Bev Jacobs is our community lead for the governance aspect. And we've been developing ways that youth could become future leaders in water advocacy. So we've partnered with different organizations at the UN. We've managed to take a few young people from Six Nations and put them in leadership programs the UN was offering, do side tables, display their research, and the youth lead, Makasha, took on the issue of Nestle, which she became rather enraged about. And so we just support their passions. Other youth are more interested in the Confederacy's environmental task force. Like whatever their interest is, we wanted to nurture that. Denise McQueen and a few others who published a recent article with me on warrior science just got invited to Paris by Green Energy. So our goal, like they're going to pay for some and then we pay for some. So the goal is to elevate the voice of Indigenous young women, in particular citizens of the Haudenosaunee, to be out there advocating and being able to have a platform to advance the interests of Six Nations, meaning we should have access to the water treatment plant water. The government hasn't been forthcoming, so to pressure the government. But also sanitation is a big issue here. If you don't have a waste treatment plant to go with your water treatment plant, that is a primary concern around water quality and water sanitation. So we have to kind of look at what our findings tell us, and then we get and access more funding to address that issue. One of the things that shocked us, I guess, it shouldn't have, but it did, is we worked with the Birthing Center. They did a survey, the Six Nations Health Services, PhD students from MEC, Afroza, and Sarah collected data, doing interviews, focus groups. The midwives helped implement the interviews with new moms. And we found that mental health was the greatest stressor to Six Nations water insecurity. It was 3 to 4 times higher than skin rashes, issues around, you know, gastrointestinal, E. coli being found in tap water and wells. We would have thought those would have been the top issues with health, but we actually found anxiety, depression, were elevated when people didn't have access to water, whether they ran out of money and they couldn't purchase a water truck to come, or whether their septic was full and they couldn't afford the $90 to get the septic truck to come and haul things away. So people are struggling at Six Nations, and it affects the day-to-day. We found women, especially young mothers, are particularly harmed by not having access to clean water. They have more incidence of wound care, infections, babies have rashes. So the health implications are quite severe. And we want to take that data, give it to the leaders and say, here you go, go after the government, because we deserve access to clean water. Our mothers should not be, our new mothers should not be struggling to get water into the home so that they can take care of their newborn baby or their own wound care. So these are all things that will helpfully advance or advocate for us to be able to secure the funds that we should have had a long time ago to give these services freely to Six Nations. And currently, as you all know, we are paying pretty high costs for water trucks as well as septic trucks.
Was it always part of the plan to combine the scientific statistics, I guess, with the Indigenous teachings and Indigenous stories and blend them together to work towards a solution to this problem?
Yes, right from the beginning. I mean, my background, I've been advocating around Indigenous knowledge and ways of knowing language for 30 years in academia, when everybody would roll their eyes every time I spoke. They did not see the value in our ways of knowing. I always did. So after the TRC, I worked diligently with the Tri-Council government, who funds all research in Canada. It's a billion-dollar industry. And they did not fund Indigenous knowledge, Indigenous ways of knowing, traditional medicine. So a lot of my work and reputation as a scholar is getting those barriers taken down. So now we can work solely either in Indigenous ways of knowing, or as I did, blend them together, or what I call braid them. So we're not trying to assimilate our ways of knowing with Western. Rather, like the true role, we're parallel. The engineers listen to what, maybe Jock Hill or Cam or other, the Grandmothers Council, Mary Sandy, are identifying as areas of concern. And then they usually come to a fairly easy agreement on how to go about addressing that particular issue. So they wanted turtle tagging because they thought turtles are indicators of the health, not only of the water, but of humans. And the leading biologist that we have on the team, Karen Kidd, an expert in mercury contamination of aquatic life in northern Ontario, said that's exactly correct. I mean, turtles would be. So it's amazing to sit in those meetings and just be quiet and watch our people direct and identify, and then the response from the, whether it's biologists, climatologists, hydrogeologists, whoever is sitting there, always concurs that is exactly what they should be doing to identify water quality or human health contaminants. So it's called co-creation, and it's fairly new. I don't know, I termed the project co-creation of Indigenous water quality tools. And now I didn't have any literature using that term. I just thought, well, that's what it is. We're co-creating a new way of doing science, and it's exciting, and hopefully we solve some problems along the way. But no, we work together, and sometimes there's tension, I'll be honest. Sometimes they don't concur, and that's when, you know, we have to figure out how to do this work together and compromise. Usually it's the science compromising and saying, okay, well, we will only look at this and I won't add the three other things that I thought I needed to add. So one of the things, for example, this is a simple example, is all the literature studies done at Six Nations on water identified phosphorus and farming, basically runoff, different types of farming contaminants. Talking to community and talking to traditional knowledge holders, they all identified heavy metals and carcinogens, PCBs, because they had worked or they were aware of somebody who worked at a plant and they were dumping, you know, highly toxic agents into the Grand River. And of course, the scientists are, well, we don't see any of that anywhere in any of the literature. And they're like, well, we want heavy metals tested. So that cost a whole lot more money to do, $50 per sample versus, you know, five or doing it in an internal lab. And then we did, you know, we did fine heavy metals. And so we're still trying to work that out. There's different metrics for heavy metals. The government might say 0.03 mercury is okay. The traditional people advisors said, no, if it's not organic, none is okay. So, you know, people get confused because they see different results. Or if you test water in your well or in the creek after a flood, it's not going to have the same, you're not going to get the exact same numbers every time. After flood incidents, there'll be less solvents in the water, but during droughts, the numbers will be very high. And so that's why we're doing the mapping, and we want the real-time sensors that the engineers created with our community, with our knowledge holders, that are going to be able to be placed in our water and in our creeks and hopefully in our wells so that we can monitor the quality. You know, it'll fluctuate based on season, based on what's happening, if there's a large dumping incident. So people want consistency. That community wants the exact same number every time. So our knowledge mobilization is about trying to explain science a bit and why they're going to see variations in numbers and why maybe one lab will have one number and our lab will have another. It's because we're using an indigenous metric, not the Canadian acceptable metric. So, you know, having a platform to explain that, we developed Let's Talk Water, the podcast. We do booklets on our website to give to community. We go to powwows. So we're trying to educate at the same time that we're actually doing the research.
And one of the topics we touched on earlier was the virtual reality experience that the research project has been working on. I did watch some of the demos on YouTube. It's sort of an experience and it lets you experience being on the Grand River as you travel through time, and you get to hear about traditional Haudenosaunee culture and witness the world around you transform. Can you tell me more about that and what your plan is for it?
Yeah, well, I wish I could tell you I had a beautiful arts grant with a whole lot of money and I had this big plan for it, but I just said, okay, we're just going to do this in phases, and I'm going to try to market it and try to find people that will help us get it out to the public once it is finished. So we didn't have a budget for VR, and this grant, I mean, Global Water Futures, doesn't, you know, give you a $500,000 to fund what it would take to create this level of a VR. Partly, I pay the knowledge holders, language, because it'll be in Mohawk Cayuga team, the script writers, the singers, actors, film crew. Like, it's very expensive. And a VR experience is not a video. It's not a documentary. It's meant to be somewhat dreamlike and somewhat entertaining. So they wanted to start with Skyworld, which in itself, I mean, we have 34 published versions of the Skyworld, and they're all variants of each other. So, you know, I asked the Clan Mother, Louise McDonald and Frank Miller, to work on it with us. And I just said, you know, we just want people to understand our worldview, and this is kind of setting the worldview up for them. And there's so much good response from various places that we've showed it. One was an invitation by Silicon Valley. This summer we went to their retreat. We showed them the VR and got their input. And these are people who made Roblox, who worked on Minecraft. These are like, this is Silicon Valley in San Francisco. So we were there for a week and they gave us really good feedback on what we should be doing, how to market it, and also helping us with some of the transition we're going to do to the gaming aspect. So what you see on our website is just kind of the story, the narrative. And now we're moving into the gaming because we do have a mental health team and we are showing the future. We're using the climate change data, and also we know about prophecy, and we didn't want to be distressing people and creating more anxiety, which is what they're exposed to every day on social media. we wanted to give them the tools to make better decisions and the right decisions so that the future for our children would be better. So the gaming component is just starting to be worked on. And I'm really excited that National Geographic, the Canadian arm, got in touch with me. They said they loved the VR. They were exposed to it on Global Water Futures website. And I'm actually meeting with them tomorrow, and they're interested in helping with the VR and the gaming component, because I guess that is their mandate with the mapping projects they've been doing. And they also love the mapping that we're doing, because we're including traditional knowledge. I've got archaeologist student Emily Anson and another one who's Oneida, who's already mapped out like over 100 archaeological sites. So we have both like the history of our land here, Peacemaker's journey is being mapped out, and those stories are embedded in our mapping. So you can like click these icons, you can hear, you know, a knowledge holder speak, you can hear the language, and then you can hear the English version and then the written, but also you can see the water quality data. So there, it all works together, and it's just finding funders and support to do that. Now, granted, you know, I haven't really, it's all GWF thus far, and I'm so overwhelmed with this amount of work that, you know, going out and writing more grants isn't, I don't have the ability to just be a machine. But I'm hoping, you know, once National Geographic picks it up, we'll get the marketing to the public that I was most worried about, and hoping that maybe, you know, some Indigenous organizations would be investing as well. Once we have it, I think, further along into the gaming component. I'm happy to report that everybody that was in California at the retreat that went to our workshops and worked with us thought that it was stellar. Like they said, there's nothing like this on the market. This will be big, especially with young people who want to learn more about Indigenous people, about traditional ecological knowledge. Like they were really impressed with the quality of work that we had done, both as a community, but Mohawk College tech people have been phenomenally great to us. So we'll be hopefully rolling it out in a year in a professional way, meaning it'll be marketed and it'll be accessible to all schools free of charge. It's just a learning tool, and it's part of the mandate of Anishinaabemowin to get that information into young people's hands. Well, anybody's hands. They also learn how to test water in it. You know, like you can learn different things and you'll get points as you go through and listen to maybe, you know, an elder speak, or if you watch a demonstration on how to test water, and you learn what good water quality is. And you learn how to operate our sensors that we're creating. So it's pretty all-inclusive, or what we call inter-transdisciplinary approach to research, which is a little bit harder than just going to an archive and writing about how beautiful our ways of knowing are. It's a little bit more challenging.
It definitely sounds like a lot, and it sounds very cool as well. And just lastly, I think the state of First Nations drinking water and the ability to have access to clean drinking water, it's continuing to garner attention in the media. But I was just wondering if you believe things are moving in the right direction, and if you had any advice you wanted to give anyone interested in researching and trying to find solutions to those issues.
I don't know that I have advice other than we all need to do research and go ahead and be critical, because the way statistics are developed, even Canada, you know, saying, oh, there's 90 water advisories in Ontario and now there's 50, that's just not true, because Six Nations isn't even in that database. If you look at the Grand River Conservation Authority, while it's a decent organization that's done a great job with the Grand River, they haven't included any sensors along Six Nations. And I think if there were sensors being included, you would see a completely deteriorated measure along the reserve of our water. I did ask them and inquire why they never put sensors along with the Grand River. So I think people need to be astute when they are looking at data, you know, is there mercury, is there not, and not get too obsessed over those little things, because at the end of the day, if you eat fish that is full of mercury, then you really have some neurological potential damage if you continue to eat that fish as they did in Grassy Narrows. We're not at that level. Like, we're not A, living off the fish like weekly, and B, we don't know how much mercury is in our fish. So people get alarmed really easily, and I found that out during this study. It's like to be very cognizant that there are things we should be concerned about, but more importantly, what can we do to clean up our water? One of the things that the Grandmothers Council and Norma General and specifically wanted was decommissioning of dams. There's over 100 dams on the Grand River. And what you want to do is clean up your source water. So everybody should be concerned about the Grand River. That is our source water. Everybody should be concerned that Doug Ford is giving away our groundwater, which is pristine, clean, good water, which is usually 100 meters down, not 40. So learning about what your rights are, and that you're letting the government give away permits against our consent, mean the duty to consult is being completely ignored. They're taking our aquifer, and according to the United Nations, by 2050, the world is going to be water insecure. The world, like over 50%. So we have gold here that nobody seems to be minding the store. Nobody, you know, there's a lot of land reclamation and fighting development. At the end of the day, without water, our children are going to have a very tough future. You can't grow food. You can't, you know, survive. The animals can't eat. Like, water is everything. And for some reason, maybe because people have just written off the Grand River, or they don't see the groundwater that is pure, pristine, beautiful water, takes the earth forever to create for humans. And we're letting Nestle and other companies extract 3.6 million liters a day, every single day. And I added up, well, I didn't, Colin, our manager did. He added up the amount, and it's about $1.7 trillion that Nestle made off of our water on our territory and then sold back to us in polluting plastic water, which is a whole nother nightmare with the amount of plastic we're consuming, because every time you open a bottle, you're consuming microplastics. They need to know those things, like where our energy should be focused as a people, should be fighting for that water, and have the government stop giving away permits, and then also going after these companies who have taken a resource. If it was oil, I think people would be like, oh, well, I should be getting royalties, or we should maybe get something out of that. Like, we're just letting them take it and go, yeah, okay, I heard about that. I won't buy Nestle water. But it's more than Nestle. Blue Triton bought the company, and the United Nations is very concerned on a global level with Blue Triton, because their worst nightmare just happened here at Six Nations. The world is watching, but I don't know that Six Nations is watching, that now it's not even an extractive water industry taking our water. They're selling our water. It's like a stock market. So now you're going to get foreign interests who are going to be benefiting off of this company called Blue Triton, who isn't even a water bottling company. We believe it's Nestle hiding behind, you know, basically a stock. So now people can take our water the way they take oil. It's on the public domain, where you can buy a stock or share or trade in our water. which is what the UN was trying to prevent. Because according to United Nations law, no groundwater that is drinkable should be sold for any reason as a commodity. And we're having people do it every day here, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of concern that this is happening. So we don't know how to address that. I think Makasha's been trying her darndest. She's got, you know, the attention of the UN and of Geneva, of Paris, all these Sweden, all these countries are concerned about this happening, this terrible new move that Nestle made through Blue Trident. And we're just like we're not as a community mobilized enough to say this needs to stop. That plant needs to be shut down. In fact, that plant should belong to Six Nations, and that water should be going into the homes of the people of Six Nations. So I think those are probably the key issues, is cleaning up the Grand River, not writing it off because it is going to be our source water, stopping, like Protect the Tract is already doing, stopping further development because the Grand River can't hold any more industry. We have 25 wastewater treatment plants upstream from us. That means all that garbage comes down to us. So we need to have more governance management over the Grand River than we currently do. And I know we got enough problems, but this one, to me, water is not a meme. Seriously, if you know the global picture, climate crisis picture, water is going to be the that's the new gold, and we're just letting it slip away from us because we have so much on our plate already. I don't know how to address that other than to continue to educate Six Nations and all the other First Nations that rely on the Great Lakes generally.
Very well said. And it's definitely a huge issue, not only here, but across the country, across the world. So thank you very much for joining me today, Dr. Martin Hill, and all the best with the continuation of your water research project.
Thank you so much for having me. Take care.
That was Dr. Don Martin Hill, professor at McMaster University and lead for the Oneganos Water Research Project.